All right, we are in Acts chapter 26. We're a pretty good ways into chapter 26. We're going to pick up tonight in verse 24. Paul is the evening's entertainment. King Agrippa and Governor Festus have come together, and they are meeting together for the first time as Festus is the new provincial governor. He's the Gentile Roman authority in the area, in the region. King Agrippa is, and it's kind of interesting because these titles are a little backwards from what we're accustomed to. King Agrippa is really more very roughly akin to maybe a mayor, what we might call a mayor. He's the head of a small region, but Governor Festus is the leader, the Roman leader of a province. And so Governor Festus has far more influence and far more authority and far more power than what King Agrippa has. So the names are a little bit backwards. But Governor Festus is the new guy in town, and so King Agrippa, being the underling, has come to pay his respects. And they've decided to have a ball, a party, a dress rehearsal, whatever. And so they are... And they're using Paul for the entertainment. They can't decide what to charge Paul with. They don't really want to send him to Caesar without any charges. Here's a guy that we don't like, and we're going to send him to you, and you figure out what to do with him. That doesn't play well with Caesar, and so they want something formal to charge. And they just evidently decided, why not just make it a fun night? And so they have like a red carpet event, and everybody comes in their regalia, and they're having it in an auditorium rather than a courthouse or a hall. And so they are. So Paul's entertainment. And so he's been before Agrippa and in these in Festus, and he's made his same. This is his third defense of himself, very much like the previous two defenses, just explaining his Damascus Road experience and the fact that he is a faithful follower of God, following God's lead, following and obeying God's commandments. And so he's not a troublemaker, he's not a problem, he's just somebody who's doing what God told him to do. He wraps up his defense in the latter part, verses 21, 22, 23, somewhere around in there. He wraps up his defense basically by saying that there's two key facets to what he's doing, or why he's doing what he's doing. Two key facets to why he's doing what he's doing. The first one is we have a Messiah. And that Messiah must suffer. He's referring, by the way, to Isaiah, the suffering servant in Isaiah. The Messiah must, we have a Messiah, the Messiah must suffer, but the Messiah would rise from the dead and be a light to all people. To an Israelite, that shouldn't sound, well, the second half shouldn't sound too unusual, that the Messiah will be a light to the world. They conveniently practice the Passover on the part of the Messiah suffering and dying, although Isaiah is very explicit. In fact, there's numerous prophecies about that in their scriptures, what we would call the Old Testament. And so Paul's basically saying, I'm here because we have a Messiah. The Messiah suffered and died. The Messiah rose from the dead, and he's a light to the world. And some of my fellow Israelites reject that. That's basically his claim. And so we'll pick up there in Acts chapter 26, and we'll read a few verses in 24, and then we'll press on. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. You're out of your mind, Paul, he shouted. Your great learning is driving you insane. I'm not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I am saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. We'll stop there. Festus has heard enough. And so his only explanation he can come up with in verse 24 is that Paul's out of his mind, which, by the way, is a fascinating argument. That's always a nice thing to do if you don't agree with somebody. Just call them crazy. They'll say they're out of their mind. Or do like Paul's opponents do and kill them. That's one of two easy solutions, either murder them or write them off as crazy. By the way, that's not the first time this has happened. If you remember back in John chapter 10, the Jews made the same accusation against Jesus. Jesus claimed in John 10 verse 20, Jesus claimed authority to lay down his life and to pick it back up. In other words, I can die and I can come back. I'm in charge of that. You're not. And they said that he had lost his mind back then. And so that claim, I find that interesting. We have some continuity. A claim that Christians find a bedrock of our faith, that our Messiah, our Savior, suffered and died, and that he rose from the dead, that he has the power to lay down his life, he has the power to pick it back up, that he has the power over death, and he is resurrected. And every time we do communion, we celebrate his death, burial, and resurrection. We proclaim his death, and what do you say? Until he returns, right? Until he comes. And so what's bedrock to our faith is craziness to those outside the faith, those who have a closed mind to a Savior who can die for his followers. So Paul, verse 25, tells Festus that his testimony is true and reasonable. Some of your translations say sober. He's not crazy. He's not drunk. He hasn't imbibed. This makes sense. It doesn't make sense in a temporal, worldly mindset, but in a cosmic, eternal mindset, it's exactly what God has promised. And then just to back it up, he turns in verse 26 to King Agrippa, which is fascinating because poor Agrippa kind of finds himself between a rock and a hard place. Now, King Agrippa is the local king. He's the mayor kind of guy. And he's an Israelite. And so he should be, by all accounts, probably a worshiping Israelite. You can look at different sources and they'll tell you whether they'll give you their opinions to whether or not he's a true faithful Israelite or if he's going through the motions. Kind of like Emperor Constantine, was he really a convert or was he just trying to do what was politically expedient? Well, different sources have different views of King Agrippa, but he was a worshiping Jew by all accounts. And so as a worshiping Jew, he's been in the synagogue and he's heard the prophecies and he's shares the same expectation of a Messiah, whether he agrees with Paul's rendering of the Messiah that suffers and dies and raises from the dead. He shares the same idea of a Messiah, the expectation of Messiah, and certainly cannot, because he's the overseer of the region where a lot of this took place, he cannot be ignorant of the excitement and the energy and the conflict around Jesus. Paul turns to him as somebody like, you know, if you're willing. In fact, you remember what Paul said about his fellow Jews. I've lived among the Jews to this very day, and they all know about my life. And if they're willing, they can testify. Well, that's kind of what Paul's doing to Agrippa. If you're willing, you can give credence to what I'm saying, that this idea of a Messiah who suffers and lays down his life and takes it back up is not foreign to the Israelites and not foreign to their past, their scriptures. And so in verse 26, he turns to him as someone who can if he will. And then as someone who's a worshiping Jew, familiar with the Jewish prophecies, he says in verse 27, you know, you can tell us about this if you will. Surely you believe in the prophecies. And verse 27, King Agrippa, do you believe in the prophets? I know you do. Okay. Now catch the scene here. We've got King Agrippa, who's the little guy. We have the brand new Roman, Governor Festus, who's the big guy. They've all put on their finery. They're trying to impress each other. It's a nice state dinner kind of a thing, not S-T-A-T-E, a nice state dinner. And Paul's putting this little fish on the spot. What's going to happen to King Agrippa if he goes, absolutely, I believe in the prophecies? If you're Paul, what are you going to do with that? Yeah, well, if you know, since you know the prophecies, since you believe in the prophecies, don't you see Jesus as the fulfillment? Everything I've been saying, everything I've been doing has just been legitimized by King Agrippa. Thank you, King. Appreciate it. Problem solved. Case dismissed. Now what happens if he says, I don't believe in the prophecies? Are you an Israelite? Really? Are you really, you know, he puts this poor guy between a rock and a hard place. So let's follow through with Agrippa's difficult spot. Let's go back to our text, Acts 26. Let's pick where we left off in verse 28. Then Agrippa said to Paul, do you think in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? Paul probably under his breath goes, yeah, that's what I hope to do. Verse 29, Paul replied, short time or long, I pray that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am. Christian, faithful, zealous, using his time, talents, and treasures for Donnell's Devo, for God's glory, except for these chains. Boy, you got to love Paul. This guy is the... God said, you're going to go preach, and Paul's just all in. I'm preaching, and I'm looking for converts. It doesn't matter where, and I believe that God can make converts anywhere, and if it's King Agrippa, that's fine. If it's, and I believe Paul means exactly what he says when he talks about verse 29 and all who are listening to me today. I think Paul would like and kind of half expect nothing less than everyone who hears him to go, yeah, I believe this Jesus guy is exactly who you claim it to be. Maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I really think Paul looks for that. So if Agrippa professes belief in the prophets, then Paul can press him to take a stand on whether or not Jesus is the one who fulfills the prophecies or not. If he wants to maintain his status as an upstanding Jew, he cannot deny that he believes the prophets. He has to hold on to that. And so he just decides the best thing to do is change the subject. Nah, you're crazy. Have you ever tried to have a conversation with somebody about your faith or their faith or Christianity in general, and you get a similar response? Let's just, hey, it's pretty hot out there, isn't it? Somebody just, let's just take a hard right and change the subject. And that's what Agrippa does here. But what's interesting is Agrippa is trying to give a diversion, and he just plays right into Paul's hand because Paul says, that's exactly what I'm doing here. Preaching for conversion, preaching for people to accept Christ. You know, you think you can turn me into a Christian in such a short time? Well, that's my purpose. That's why I'm here. That's what I'm doing. That's why I live. That's the commission I've been given by God. And so he doesn't really care. The eternal optimist hopes that his testimony will convince Agrippa and Bernice and Festus and all who are attending this wonderful party that Paul is the entertainment for, that Jesus is the Messiah. Well, since the diversion didn't work, we're just going to call the proceedings to a close. A little behind the curve. Acts 26, verse 30. The king rose, and with him the governor and Bernice and those sitting with them. They left the room, and while talking with one another, they said, this man's not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. That sounds good. That plays well with your hearers. I'm not really sure that's true, because there's a group of really malcontent Israelites waiting to kill him if they can get him free from Roman protection. You remember when he was sent, was it Felix? Who are we talking about now? Felix, the governor before, sent him to Caesarea with 470 soldiers because there was a plot to kill him. So it sounds nice. We could just let him go, but that's not really the case. But what he is saying is accurate is they don't have a case against Paul. There's really nothing that they can... They're no closer to having a charge to send with Paul to Caesar than they were before, 2 years before. They've been waiting 2 years trying to get this figured out, and they're not any closer to getting it done. So Paul has appealed to Caesar, and so to Caesar he must go. He's not done anything that deserves punishment in a Roman court. Nothing that the Romans can charge him with, but he's appealed to Caesar, so to Caesar he must go. All right, that brings our trial to a close. And let's just, a few more thoughts before we jump into chapter 27. First of all, no one in authority has found anything to charge Paul with that's worth charging Paul. No one in authority to press charges has been able to find anything, has been able to have anything that's worthy of even discussing, much less anything that sticks. The driving force behind Paul's problems, and you check me on this and tell me if you think I'm overstating or understating, The driving force behind Paul's problems is a small group, a small faction of his fellow Jews who reject Jesus as the Messiah. His problem isn't the Romans. His problem isn't the majority of the Jews. It's a rather small faction who have decided that they're rejecting Jesus as the Messiah, and therefore they must reject his prophets, his messengers. Paul was there once, but that's really the problem, right? I mean, I don't think I'm overstating or understating. I think we're kind of there. And so the bottom line is simply Jesus. He says, don't think I've come to bring peace. Come to bring division. And he didn't, Paul, Jesus' purpose is not to cause division. Jesus' purpose is to bring a point of decision. And those who decide for Christ are saved, and those who decide against are lost. But you can't come across or contact with Jesus without coming to a decision point, a fork in the road. You have to make a choice. And so there are people who have made the wrong choice, you and I know from history, and that has put them at odds with Paul. And that's really the problem. And I think maybe that might be where we find our timeless lesson for today out of this. You and I, 21st century Westerners and Western Christians, we're blessed to live in a country that gives us more religious freedom than most. Used to be able to say that gave us complete religious freedom, and that's probably... That statement probably needs to be couched a little bit now. But we still live in a country that gives us more religious freedom than almost any other country in the world that I know of, right? So really, if there's turmoil within among the believers in our world, it's usually not outsiders. Usually if there's turmoil within the Lord's church today, at least in our country, it's usually from within. Same thing Paul faced 2,000 years ago. He was preaching a message, and some people didn't like it, and they didn't respond well. All the trouble that Paul's facing is because there's a few of his fellow Israelites who reject Jesus as the Messiah. He's preaching and teaching the truth. He's doing what God called him to do. He's doing what Jesus commissioned him to do. He's doing what he was told it was his purpose, and God's working, God continues to work his will through the trouble, but how much more could God do and how much easier would it be for Paul to do it if he didn't have that trouble from those within? His trouble comes from his own people, and that's really where Satan finds the ability to cause most of the trouble in our world, in the church today. In our world, in America. Now, there are places where being a Christian is a life-threatening commitment, a life-threatening profession to profess faith in Christ. Not here. Here, most of our problems comes from ourselves, from within, and Satan getting within the Lord's church and tickling the ears of people who unfortunately hear his word. So the answer to that, I think, is what Paul writes to the church in Rome and elsewhere as well. But Romans 14 is kind of the poster child for that. Stand firm on the salvation issues, no matter the cost. Do not flinch. Do not give on salvation issues. But on everything else, be flexible. All right, I'm going to bring his trial to a close with those words. Any thoughts before we move on to next chapter, Todd? And then here, and then here. So Paul's conduct in this trial is a model for us as we go out in the community, for, as you point, for black gold. I'm doing that for those who yeah.
Look at me respectfully.
Yeah.
Firmly. Defends the faith.
Yeah.
And in conclusion, he is a direct appeal to the people to come follow the gospel. I mean, there's nothing complicated about it, and he's well-rounded.
He doesn't pander. He doesn't play into their games. He stays on track, on message. His message is, I'm just doing what God called me to do. And I'm just proclaiming what God called me to proclaim. I'm not violating any Roman laws. I'm not violating any Jewish scriptures. I'm just doing what God called me to do and stayed on task. And that you're, well, so as we go out in the community, who knows what we might come into, but stay on task, keep it simple, and point to Christ. And trust, you know, so all right, let's just do this. Paul's watering, Paul's planting, right? He's trusting God to give the increase, but he's offering the invitation. He's watering and planting with high expectations and trusting God to give the increase. Yeah, ever the optimist, which is probably a good message for us as we go out in the world. Be optimistic and love on people. Mr. Larry? Yes.
And the fact that, you know, we want to please the world and we want to please God. And it's hard to teach the word whenever you're teaching against what people are wanting to do. And
okay, so there's a faction of non-believers who, help me with the please God and please ourselves.
Believers or non-believers.
Okay. Okay. Is that are we so help me with the, are we making the correlation with the disgruntled Israelites? Okay, all right. So they're disgruntled, and part of it's because while they have a heart for pleasing God, they also have at least an equal heart for pleasing themselves.
They said here that they knew that they didn't have enough to put him to death.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We don't have enough on him, but he's in the system. Isn't that fascinating? You've got a faction of Jews who want to kill him. You've got a Jewish leader, a mayor, king, mayor. You've got a Roman provincial governor, and they all are looking out for themselves. What is most expedient for me? How can I manage this so that it serves me? Now, is that kind of where you're going with? Yeah, okay. And I don't know that anybody's immune to that temptation. Whether or not we give into it or not, we're certainly, I don't know of anyone who's immune to that. How can I work this to my best advantage? Hadn't changed much in 2,000 years, has it? You pressed it, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's, I see Paul, and he didn't overlook anything.
Paul, yeah. Paul's not a diplomat. That's not Paul's calling to be a diplomat, is it? Yeah. And it's what's, okay, Larry, you've mentioned more than once that you've got a significant time in service. Am I saying that okay? Isn't it a little disappointing, maybe even deflating, to go all the way back to Genesis and find that humanity is still doing the same stupid stuff they did back in Genesis, that we haven't seemed to evolve very much? I mean, we're driving cars and going to the moon, but we're making the same stupid mistakes that Cain made.
I just wonder what God thinks about
it. Yeah, what does God think? Yeah. Mr. Jim.
I was going to make a comment on the last verse that Ken Griffin, you do believe the prophets. I know you do.
I know you do.
Isn't that being said all the way through this thing to those, that group that wanted to kill him? They believed the prophets. They just didn't believe that he was the dude. They just didn't believe he wasn't the guy they were looking to see and come. And so they're not going to buy into it. And yet they did say, well, we've got to admit this guy does miracles.
He does miracles. He's raised people from the dead. But what is that? I mean, what's that? Right.
what their complaint was it? And I think it stemmed from the fact that the power that they had, they saw slipping away. He didn't come to them and say, I need you guys to get on board. You're going to be my apostles.
Yeah.
He went to the law, the fisherman.
Yeah.
He
didn't make any friends doing that, yeah. So all right. Let's. There's a few tiers to what you're saying here, which there's lots of levels to that. In terms of the Jewish leadership, absolutely, they felt cut out, left out, disrespected, rejected when he picked fishermen and tax collectors to do what they should be doing, if they were to buy into his message. The group that seems to be wanting to kill Paul is not so much leadership. I reserve the right to be wrong. I believe it's more just a general group of malcontents who, as you point out so clearly, reject Jesus as the Messiah. We see the prophecies. We've read the prophecies. We know we're expecting Messiah. We just don't think that guy's him. And I think the biggest obstacle that most of the Israelites had to accepting Jesus as the Messiah was over the years, their preachers and teachers, their scribes and their teachers had built an aura of a Messiah who is going to be the warrior king like David, who's going to do away with our enemies. Just as David did away with the Philistines, this guy's going to do away with the Romans. So they had, unfortunately, created an aura of a cheap Messiah. Not a Messiah who's going to deal with sin and death and Satan. Messiah is going to deal with our little problems, our Roman problem. And so they were so short-sighted, the ones that were against with Paul and many of the Jews as well, that they just fixed my immediate problem. And you've probably done this. I know you have. If you've helped with benevolence, there are some people who I don't really care about my soul, my salvation, my eternity. I just need gas money to get me down to the next town. And that's kind of where they are. You know, I've got this little problem. This problem that seems big to me, it's the Romans. So we have the leadership who's mad because they're being cut out. We have the general population who's mad because they want what they want. They want a guy who's going to bring them pride, prestige, power, the heady days of David's kingdom. And then we've got the authorities, King Agrippa, Governor Festus and Felix and those guys who are like, we're just politicians trying to figure out how to make this work for us. So like what you point out is like several different tiers of things. And unfortunately, all those kind of worked. They worked the way God had intended them to work within human will. Those who wouldn't hear chose not to hear. Now, let's bring this into our laps. Let's put this in my lap and your lap. They heard what they wanted to hear about a Messiah. We don't really care for the suffering part. We're going to let Isaiah just kind of keep his stuff and Jeremiah. We'll let those guys keep that stuff. We're going to talk about the Messiah who's the deliverer like David, who's the provider like Moses. Well, that's the guy. That's the part we want to hear. All that was in their scriptures. They just chose to kind of practice, the cafeteria-style religion. I'll take a little bit of victory. I'll take a little bit of power. I'll take a little bit of prestige. But I'm cutting back on the service and the sacrifice and the suffering. So that's why they got a skewed view of the Messiah. If we're not careful, we can do the same thing. I want the victory that comes with being with Christ. I want the success that comes with being with Christ. But I'm not sure, as Donnell pointed out in his message, that I want the sacrifice and the service, the humble service, the one who's last. I don't really like that. And I'll go back to that, what we said before many, many times. The best way to find out if you have a servant heart is how do you react when people treat you like a servant? If you blow up and get kind of frustrated when people treat you like a servant. Well, we delivered a bed to those people over there and they didn't even say thank you. Okay, they're treating you like a servant. How you doing? So we got to be careful that we don't do that same cafeteria-style religion that Paul's opponents did. Or that the rulers did that shouldn't we be the ones who get the glory and hear the accolades? Shouldn't we be the one who have the power and the strength? We need to be careful that we don't have that same selective hearing where they just ignored the parts of the Messiah that pointed to Jesus and said, he's the guy. And they missed that part because they were looking for a power position. Yes, sir. Thank you. By the way, thank you, Jim, for all, bringing several different levels to us. Thank you very much. Donnell.
Well, and speaking about those levels, you know, it's ironic because each one of them had their own purpose.
Yeah. Every faction had their own self-serving purposes. Yeah.
Even to the extent that they brought him in as the shoulder.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but God is revealing over and over again that his will is going to be done. You know, because he told Paul early on, you know, he's got to speak to Gentiles. And kings.
Yeah, yeah. So everybody's self-serving. Everybody's, what's it? How can I twist this for me? And God told Paul that during this trial, don't worry, you're going to be my witness in Rome. What comes next right after this? He appealed to Caesar. To Caesar he must go. Where's Caesar? Rome. It looks like all things are falling apart. Everything's against Paul. Woe is me. Nothing's working. Everybody's mad. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to eat worms and die. So it's like we have all the different factions. They're all against me. And nobody cares to, nobody except, okay, I'm going to say this. This is a really broad brush. Nobody but Paul is asking, what does God want out of this? If you were to ask the religious elites, they would probably say, yes, we're serving God by protecting our position. If you were to ask the faction that wanted to kill Paul, yes, we're serving God by getting rid of a false prophet. They might have, but in reality, nobody's really seeking God's will but Paul. Everybody else is just in it for themselves. And Paul's got a little of that. And that's, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but he threw that word bomb in the Sanhedrin. I'm just here because I believe in life after death. Knowing it, I think he knew exactly what that would do. Appeal to Caesar, he knew exactly what that would do. But in the midst of everybody trying to serve themselves, God's will be done. 470 soldiers to get him from Jerusalem to Caesarea. A Roman escort to get him from Caesarea to Rome. It looks like things are falling apart and God's working. And what's fascinating is to see God work his will through people who don't give a flip about God. And who even the ones who would intentionally work against God. And God still works in them and with them and through them to accomplish his will. Which is which is an encouragement for the fact that when through Christ we have peace with God. Because if he's that powerful, we don't want to be his enemy. Because if he can work his will through his enemies, then what hope do we have? So, great deal. Yes, sir. Yeah.
But they're the ones who, especially the 40 conspirators, who made the oath to kill.
Yeah.
And yet the Romans, who are, there's a warring nation, ultimately ends up being the one that protects it.
The Gentile pagans who couldn't give a flip. This whole argument's over some dead guy named Jesus that Paul says is alive. That's their theology. That's their faith. We got zero faith. We got zero skin in the game. Could care less about this Jewish argument. And God's working with them, the most powerful military in the world, to protect his messenger, to send his messenger to Rome. And what's fascinating to me, you read some commentaries, and the commentaries say, well, Luke just wrote this as a defense against Paul because Luke knows Paul's going to go before Caesar in Rome. There's certainly some defense in here because you can't come back to these conclusions over and over again that the Roman authorities don't find anything worth charging Paul. That would play really well before Caesar, right? But if we stop it there, that so cheapens what Luke has done through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. What he's done is show us over and over and over again that it doesn't matter what it looks like, God's in control. God's in control. God's leading this. It can look like a chaos. It can look like a wreck. It can look like that everything's against Paul. And what you see is God's will methodically, systematically being done over and over again. And Luke, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, wrote that. A defense for Paul before Caesar? Maybe. Big picture, God's in charge? Absolutely. Was there a hand back here again? Okay. Yeah.
It cannot be. They had to have sat and listened to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, or some of them did.
You'd like to think so, yeah.
Said, what? If I get hit on the left cheek, I'm supposed
turn
to
turn the other cheek, yeah. Lusting is adultery? Nah.
For what they were looking,
yeah.
They wanted David. They wanted somebody bigger than life. They wanted somebody that was going to take the role and put them.
Fix my immediate problem. We'll worry about the long term stuff later. So what's your, I read an article not too long ago, a few weeks ago, they were saying, talking about not the powers of persuasion, but an effort of persuasion, trying to change minds. And what was really disheartening, it's almost kind of like human nature hasn't changed since Genesis. What they were saying was, especially two people have two different religious views, and you're trying to talk about religious the difference in religious views. And their point was, the more you try to convince someone with an opposing viewpoint, the more it tends to entrench them in their position where they're at. So, you know, the status of miracles, the role of the Holy Spirit, a cappella versus instrument, I mean, it doesn't matter, you pick one. The more, if there's two opposing views, the tendency of human nature is, the more you try to persuade, the more that person digs their heels in. And so, what if they heard the Sermon on the Mount and it didn't fit their scenario of what they expected? And if that guy's article was correct, then all that did was just kind of dig the heels in. And I know I've been guilty of that sometimes. Somebody presides. I say I reserve the right to grow and learn and change my mind, but you have to work pretty hard because I tend to dig my heels in. And so I'm with you. There's a lot of people that heard his message that didn't respond to it the way he wanted to respond. And it's just what's wide, and wide is the gate, and many pass through, and narrow is the one that leads to salvation, and only a few find it therein. It takes a heart that wants to hear. Parable of the sower, it takes a heart that has fertile soil for the seed to land. Our job is still to plant and water, black gold days. But it takes a heart that's a receptive field. Ah, see what you guys did? Great conversation, by the way. Great points. Yes? Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. At this point, we can't admit Jesus is the Messiah because we were the ones shouting, crucify him. We're invested too much in this now. We're too deep into it to back out now. And how many times have you had a conversation with someone like that about baptism? Well, I can't accept that because I have family members I love who weren't baptized, and so I can't accept that because if I do that, then what's that? What are the ramifications? What's the cost? And so if they were the ones who were saying, let's get rid of Paul, let's get rid of Jesus, then we can't change because we don't want to own what that leads to. Great point. Excellent point. Isn't it amazing? We've read this story. It's biography, and it could be dry history, but God's behind this, pointing us to the future and pointing us to confidence in him. And if we'll use the gifts and talents that he's given us, and we use them in service to the kingdom, and we use them as servants in the service, then we can trust that no matter what it looks like, God's behind the scenes, and his will be done. Thank you for that. God bless you. We'll pick up, Lord willing, next week with Paul as he gets on the ship and heads for Rome. Thank you all. God bless you. We're dismissed.